Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. Happy St. Patrick's Day. The headline is Officials Plot Pool Openings. Galena and Platteville move toward reopenings, Dubuque undecided, by Benjamin Fisher. Even with fresh snowfall on the ground, local cities are looking ahead to swimming pool season. Officials in some area communities, including Galena, Illinois, and Platteville, Wisconsin, are moving forward with plans to open again. In Dubuque, City Recreation Director Dan Kroger said it is still unclear if Flora and Sutton pools will open. He is developing a proposal to present to City Manager Mike Van Milligan before early April. The two municipal pools did not open last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic, so developing a plan from scratch, especially for two locations, is taking a great deal of consideration. Quote, "One of the things we're looking at is the capacity," Kroger said. "The Iowa Department of Public Health has provided a calculation for cities to use to determine the patron load for open swim, so we're running those," unquote. Additionally, as of now, the city of Dubuque has a mask mandate in place. "We also have to figure out the queue system," Kroger said. "We're considering different entrances for those with passes and those who are visiting. If you can imagine 100 people in line 6 feet apart, that is a long line," unquote. Kroger said it is certain there will be capacity reductions if pools open. "It's all going to have to be a fluid process," he said. No pun intended. Galena City Council members recently voted to open the municipal swimming pool this summer with capacity caps and required registration. Galena has a head start over some other cities in the area, as their pool was open for some of the summer of 2020. "We're planning that all of our timelines and normal hours of operation will be as closely aligned to normal as possible," said Galena Facilities Manager Janelle Kiefer. "The biggest change will be breaking up the day to allow for social distancing. Phase 4 of Illinois' reopening schedule requires a maximum capacity of 125 people. To accommodate that, the pool's open swim periods will run from 1 to 3:30 p.m. and again from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Between those, all patrons will have to exit the pool. A new group of swimmers will be allowed in for the second session. Monitoring that will be done through online registration required for entry. We're developing a brand new website for that, for the convenience of our customers," Kiefer said. "We will also have a staffed phone line for people who don't want to register online." The second big change for this summer is no concession stand at Galena's pool. Kiefer said the city plans to install vending machines and will allow patrons to bring in water. Galena will not rent out the pool for private parties this summer. The city of Platteville also plans to open its pool. It, too, had a trial run during the pandemic of 2020. Parks and Recreation Department Administrative Assistant Debbie Sigworth said that at that time, the city capped the number of patrons at 100. She said the city had not decided what restrictions will be in place this year, given the ever-changing nature of the pandemic. Sigworth noted that swim lessons likely will be reduced in size to control the number of children and parents at any one time. Other area cities are working out their plans. The city of Bellevue, Iowa, also kept its pool closed in 2020, but according to city administrator Abby Skrivseth, the smaller pool requires a simpler, smaller plan to open this summer. Quote, "We're talking about spacing out the kids in swim lessons, so we might now have the full 6 sessions every hour," she said. "We'll spread people out on our sun deck, but it might be more difficult in the pool, although our pool is so small that it doesn't really draw people from other communities," unquote. Skrivseth said Bellevue has not yet considered a capacity limit, but recognized that plans will have to be adaptable. According to Cascade, Iowa City Manager Deanna McCusker, the city council there has agreed to open the pool, but specific plans still were being formulated. The next article is March Madness Gets a Little Crazier by Eric Hogstrom. After a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic, March Madness returns this week with a few changes designed to reduce the impact of COVID-19. The 81st annual NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament begins Thursday, March 18th, with the first four play-in games and concludes with the national championship game on April 5th. This year's Women's NCAA Tournament is being held in San Antonio. Here are 15 things to know about this year's tournaments. 1. In a bid to mitigate the risk of COVID-19 by reducing travel, all of the men's tournament games will be played in Indiana. Venues include Lucas Oil Stadium, Bankers Life Fieldhouse, Indiana Farmers Coliseum, and Hinkle Fieldhouse, all in Indianapolis, Mackey Arena in West Lafayette, and Assembly Hall in Bloomington. The final four games will be played on April 3rd and the national title game on April 5th, all at Lucas Oil Stadium. 2. Members of each school's travel party had to test negative for COVID-19 for 7 straight days before heading to Indiana, according to the NCAA. Referees followed those guidelines too. Teams, coaches, and others included in a school's travel party will be tested daily for COVID-19. During the tournament, if a team does not have at least 5 healthy players to start a game, the NCAA will classify the game as a no contest, and the opponents will advance to the next round. 3. The tournament's 67 games will be broadcast on TBS, CBS, TNT, and True TV, and streamed on the NCAA's March Madness Live app. Women's tournament games will air on ESPN's networks. 4. The number 11 seed Drake Bulldogs were selected for the men's tournament for the first time since 2008. Drake faces number 11 Wichita State in a first four play-in game at 5:27 p.m. Thursday, March 18th. The game will air on TBS. Drake went 25-4 overall, 15-3 in the Missouri Valley Conference, to earn an at-large bid for the tournament. 5. Head coach Darian DeVries is in his third season leading the Bulldogs. The Iowa native and Northern Iowa graduate comes from an athletic family. His brother Jared was an All-American football player at Iowa who spent 12 years in the NFL with the Detroit Lions. 6. The number 1 seed Illinois Fighting Illini will open tournament play against 16th-seeded Drexel at 12:27 p.m. Friday, March 19th, in a game broadcast on TBS. Illinois is in its first men's NCAA tournament since 2012 and 13, and is a number 1 seed for the first time since 2005. The Colonial Athletic Association champion Dragons are in the tournament for the first time in 25 years. The Illini are led by junior Ayo Dosunmu, who was named a first-team Associated Press All-American on Tuesday, and sophomore Kofi Cockburn, named to the AP second team. Dosunmu averages 20.7 points per game, and Cockburn averages 17.6 points per game, and had 16 double-doubles this season. 7. The 9th-seeded Wisconsin Badgers face number 8-seed North Carolina at 6:10 p.m. Friday, March 19th, in a game airing on CBS. Wisconsin makes its 25th trip to the tournament, having appeared in 21 of the past 22 editions of March Madness. The Badgers and the Tar Heels have met twice before in the NCAA tournament, with Wisconsin beating North Carolina in the 2015 Sweet 16 round, and the Tar Heels winning in the 2005 Elite Eight. The Badgers are led by 6-foot guard Demetric Trice, a senior who averages 13.8 points per game. 8. Wisconsin head coach Greg Gard is a Cobb, Wisconsin native and a 1995 graduate of University of Wisconsin-Platteville. He previously coached at Southwestern High School in Hazel Green and at Platteville High School before becoming an assistant at UWP and then Wisconsin. The second-seeded Iowa Hawkeyes face number 15-seed Grand Canyon University at 5:25 p.m. Saturday, March 20th. The game will air on TBS. 9. The Hawkeyes make its NCAA tournament debut, the Antelopes became a Division I program 8 years ago. Fran McCaffrey is in his 11th season as Iowa head coach and on Monday signed a 4-year contract extension through 2027 and 28. 10. The Hawkeyes are led by National Player of the Year candidate Luca Garza. The 6'11" senior from Washington, D.C. averaged 23.7 points and 8.8 rebounds per game and was named the Big Ten Men's Basketball Player of the Year. Garza is Iowa's all-time leading scorer. 11. In the women's tournament, 5th-seeded Iowa faces number 12-seed Central Michigan at 11 a.m. Sunday, March 21st. The game will air on ESPN. 7th-seeded Iowa State plays number 10-seed Michigan at 5 p.m. Monday, March 22nd. ESPN will broadcast the game. 12. Dubuque native Wallert Catholic High School graduate and former Iowa Hawkeye Cordell Pemsel now plays for Virginia Tech, the number 10 seed in the South region. Pemsel averaged 2.3 points and 2.5 rebounds in 12 games for the Hokies. A graduate student, Pemsel missed 9 games due to injury this season. 13. Cascade, Iowa native Greg McDermott is the head coach at Creighton, the number 5 seed in the West. 14. A Creighton assistant coach, Paul Lusk, spent one season, 2002 and 2003, as head coach at University of Dubuque. And 15, Brad Soderberg is an assistant coach at Virginia, the number 4 seed in the West. He coached at Loras College from 1988 to 1993. The last story from the front page is Alzheimer's caregiver numbers shrink. An aging population requires more people with helping hands, by Bennett Goldstein. The total number of people living with Alzheimer's disease in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin continues to increase, but fewer caretakers are available to care for them. The findings are highlighted in a new report released by the Chicago-based Alzheimer's Association. Quote, "They have it especially hard. The burden on caregivers has gone up," said Lauren Livingston, spokesperson of the organization's Iowa chapter. "All the things that go into caregiving have increased." Unquote. As boomers age, the proportion of older adults in the country is increasing. Practitioners also are getting better at detecting and diagnosing Alzheimer's dementia at earlier stages of the disease. About 66,000 people in Iowa live with Alzheimer's dementia, a 1.5% increase over the previous year. The number in Wisconsin increased 1% to 120,000 people, while the number of people in Illinois remained about the same, 230,000 people. Racial disparities also exist. About 10% of white seniors have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia, compared to more than 18% of black seniors and 14% of Hispanic seniors. The findings are attributed to disparities in healthcare access and socioeconomic inequalities. Meanwhile, the association reported the number of unpaid caregivers has declined significantly to about 73,000 in Iowa, 196,000 in Wisconsin, and 381,000 in Illinois. With fewer hands to spread duties, unpaid caretakers are working more. Research indicates that a caregiver today provides about 20% more hours of care weekly compared to those a decade ago, according to the report. Dickeyville, Wisconsin resident Doris Cooley was diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia in 2013. Although she started to forget people and how to cook, she could brush her teeth and comb her hair. Her husband, the late Laverne Cooley, remained her primary caretaker. They had been married for more than 60 years. Quote, "It hurt him to see her forget who he was," said their daughter Kate Vickerman, a Dubuque nurse. Once, Doris put the wrong soap into the dishwasher and bubbles spread all over the floor. Doris occasionally turned on a burner as if she were going to fry something, only to forget and leave the room. "A couple of times she had walked out of the apartment and Dad had to drive to find her," Vickerman said. Vickerman and several of her 9 siblings regularly assisted their father. "He had his own health issues," she said. The strain of caregiving exacts a toll. The report indicated that about 60% of caretakers reported high emotional stress, 24% reported depression, and 13% reported poor physical health. Laverne struggled with the decision to move Doris to Epione Pavilion, a Cuba City, Wisconsin nursing home. Quote, "You felt like you were abandoning her," Vickerman said. "You were putting her in a good situation to keep her safe, but there is that little feeling that you somehow failed her," unquote. More patients are entering long-term care facilities, Livingston said, but nursing homes face staffing shortages, a trend exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 20 nursing homes in the tri-states faced nursing staff or nursing or medical aid shortages within the past year, according to federal data. Quote, "There are not enough staff members to go around to these long-term care facilities," unquote, Livingston said. Doris died in 2016 at age 85. Family said Laverne's heart broke after he lost her, and he died 1 year later from an apparent heart attack. Vickerman said caregivers should take advantage of programs offered by the Alzheimer's Association, including support groups. They have been held virtually throughout the pandemic, and resources can be accessed at www.bit.ly/3TED0EH. They've got to take care of themselves, she said. Turning to page 2, county records 200th COVID-19 death. Total has reached nearly 1 year after Dubuque County's first case was reported in 2020. Dubuque County reached an unfortunate milestone between 5 p.m. Sunday and 5 p.m. Monday, 200 COVID-19 related deaths of county residents. One additional such death was reported in the 24-hour period. The total was reached nearly 1 year after the county's first confirmed COVID-19 case was reported on March 19, 2020. The county's and the state's first COVID-19 related death was Dubuque resident Kathy Davis on March 24th of last year. The county reached 50 related deaths on October 3rd, 13th, 100 related deaths on December 5th, and 150 related deaths on January 17th. Dubuque County's related death toll remains the sixth highest in the state. More related deaths have been reported in the Iowa counties of Polk, 575 as of 5 p.m. Tuesday, Linn County, 320, Blackhawk, 297, Scott, 219, and Woodbury, 215. There are 6 Wisconsin counties that have had at least 200 related deaths and 13 such counties in Illinois. Meanwhile, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination. Tuesday's other developments included: Lafayette County officials reported one additional related death between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday. As of 5 p.m. Tuesday, 74,228 residents in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, or 24.6% of the area's population. Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 2% as of 5 p.m. Tuesday. Rates for other area counties in Iowa were Clayton County, 1.3%, Delaware County, 13.2%. Delaware County is 3.2%, Jackson County, 3.5%, and Jones County, 3.2%. Iowa did not provide new county-level hospitalization data on Tuesday. The number of residents with COVID-19 in Iowa grew by 441 in the 24-hour span, increasing the state's total to 343,516. The state's death toll grew by 15 to 5,657. As of 5 p.m. Tuesday, 413,202 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, but no new vaccination data was provided between 5 p.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 480 additional cases as of 5 p.m. Tuesday, increasing the state's total to 570,412. 3 additional related deaths were reported, remaining at 6,539. Wisconsin also reported 1,273,705 residents had received at least one dose of vaccine, or 21.9% of the state's population. Statewide, Illinois reported 1,997 additional cases in 24 hours, increasing the state's total to 1,212,110. The state reported 19 additional related deaths in 24 hours, increasing the death toll to 20,973. Illinois also reported 1,563,294 residents were fully vaccinated, or 12.2% of the state's population. And here are the area COVID-19 cases as of Tuesday by county. In Iowa, Clayton County has 1,611 confirmed cases, 55 deaths, 1,541 people recovered, and 15 active cases. In Delaware County, 1,885 confirmed cases, 40 deaths, 1,797 recovered, and 48 active cases. In Dubuque County, 12,515 confirmed cases, 200 deaths, recovered are 11,961, and there are still 354 active cases. In Jackson County, 2,115 confirmed cases, 39 deaths, 2,036 recovered, and that leaves 40 cases still active. In Jones, there are 2,866 confirmed cases, deaths or 55, recovered 2,776, and active cases is 35. In Illinois, in Joe Davis County, there were 1,629 confirmed cases, 24 deaths, 1,578 recovered, and 27 still active cases. In Wisconsin, in Crawford County, there were 1,697 confirmed cases, 17 deaths, 1,674 recovered, and 6 active cases still. In Grant County, 4,718 confirmed cases, 82 deaths, 4,587 recovered, and there are still 49 active cases. In Iowa County, there were 1,925 confirmed cases, 10 deaths, 1,871 recovered, and there are still 44 active cases. And in Lafayette County, there were 1,481 confirmed cases, 7 deaths, recovered are 1,472, and there are still 2 active cases. And in COVID-19 vaccination data by county, we have in Iowa, in Clayton County, at least one dose has been given to 4,451 people. That is 25.3% of the county. Fully vaccinated are 2,147 people, and that is 12.2% of the county. In Delaware County, 3,876 people have received at least one dose. That represents 22.7% of the county. Fully vaccinated are 2,053 people, and that represents 12% of the county. In Dubuque County, at least one dose has been given to 25,795 people, and that represents 26.5% of the population. Fully vaccinated are 14,618 people, or 15% of the county. In Jackson County, 4,664 people have been vaccinated. That represents 23.9% of the county. Fully vaccinated are 2,225, and that represents 11.4% of the county. In Jones County, 4,596 people have received at least one dose, or 22.2% of the county. fully vaccinated are 2,544, or 12.3% of the county. In Illinois, 4,181 people have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and that is 19.5% of the county. Fully vaccinated are 2,544, or 12.3%. In Illinois, 4,181 people have received at least one dose, or 19.5%. Fully vaccinated are 2,367 people, or 11%. In Wisconsin, in Crawford County, 3,996 people have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and that represents 24.8% of the county. 2,157 have been fully vaccinated, and that represents 13.8% of the county. In Grant County, 11,828 people have received at least one dose, or 23% of the county. 8,821 people have been fully vaccinated, or 17.2% of the county. In Iowa County, 6,580 people have received at least one dose, or 27.8% of the county. 4,300 people are fully vaccinated, and that represents 18.4% of the county. In Lafayette County, 4,261 people have received at least one dose, or 25.6%. Fully vaccinated are 3,028, or 18.2%. That's it for the COVID news. Here's another story with the headline, Hard Rock Musician Known for Stone Sour and Slipknot Return to Dubuque. Corey Taylor is set to take the stage June 15th at the Five Flags Center. Tickets will go on sale on Friday. By Jeff Montgomery. A hard rock musician who has fronted a pair of popular bands will return to Dubuque in June. Corey Taylor will take the stage at Five Flags Center on June 15th, according to the facilities manager, H.R. Cook. Taylor is known as the lead singer of Slipknot and Stone Sour. Stone Sour is known for hits such as Through Glass, while Slipknot's most popular hits include Psychosocial, The Devil and I, Duality, and Before I Forget. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday, March 19th at the Five Flags box office and fiveflagscenter.com. Cook said 1,500 tickets will be sold, representing about one-third of the overall capacity of Five Flags. Quote, I believe this show will do very well, if not sell out completely, within the first couple of weeks, he said. What we've seen since putting shows on sale again is that there is truly a pent-up demand for people to return to shows and live events, unquote. On Saturday, Five Flags hosted its first major event in about 1 year. A concert by country star Lee Bryce was expected to draw 2,300 people. Cook was largely pleased with the behavior of those in attendance. Quote, people want to return to live music, but they realize there is a price to pay for attending these events, he said. That price is you need to wear a mask, you need to maintain social distance, and you cannot crowd up against the stage, unquote. Iowa is among few states in the U.S. that are considered open for business when it comes to live entertainment. As a result, venues such as Five Flags are paving the way for other U.S. venues that are grappling with how to reintroduce live entertainment. Cook said a representative from a large Chicago concert venue attended the Bryce show to see how the process unfolded. Other out-of-state promoters called Five Flags after the show to see how things went. While Cook said the vast majority of attendees were compliant, he acknowledged some challenges. He said one person was turned away from the concert with a refund because the individual refused to wear a mask. On top of that, there were some difficulties when it came to enforcing rules throughout the show. Quote, when the lights go down and the artists come on stage, it is harder to see the patrons, and at that point, sometimes the masks go down, unquote, he said. Taylor played 2 sold-out shows at the more intimate Q Showroom at Q Casino and Hotel in Dubuque in April 2019. Cook believes that the Five Flags show will give some fans another chance to see him perform, as well as giving an altogether new audience their initial chance to see the artist. What's great about this show is it is available to all ages, so there's a younger crowd that can see him play, said Cook. And now to the News in Brief column. Dubuque man accused of local sex crime pleads guilty to federal child porn charge. A Dubuque man charged locally for allegedly asking a woman's permission to sexually abuse a child recently pleaded guilty to a federal child porn charge. Douglas J. Butterkoffer, Jr., 40, pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to a charge of accessing child pornography. He faces up to 20 years in federal prison on the conviction. There is no parole in the federal system. As part of a plea deal, it is anticipated that two other federal charges, distribution of child porn and receipt of child porn, will be dismissed. According to court documents, Butikoffer sent two child porn videos on March 20, 2020, to an undercover federal officer during the course of an investigation targeting producers, distributors, and possessors of child pornography. In a separate investigation, Butikoffer was indicted in October 2019 by an Illinois grand jury on 3 counts of unlawful grooming. According to police, Butikoffer contacted a woman and asked her to allow him to sexually abuse a preteen girl for whom the woman was the guardian. The attempt occurred in Joe Davies County. The Telegraph-Herald does not provide identifying information for victims of alleged sexual crimes. His next hearing in that case is set for Thursday, June 24th. $250,000 grant to help redevelop Mineral Point Building. Dateline Mineral Point, Wisconsin. A state grant will help redevelop a former garden center building in Mineral Point's downtown. The city is receiving a $250,000 Community Development Investment Grant from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. A press release states that the grant will help transform the neglected property into a wine production site and event space. The city is partnering with the American Wine Project to implement the redevelopment. The American Wine Project was founded in 2018 by Aaron Rasmussen and purchased the 2-acre site in 2019. The grant will be used to cover building renovations, refrigeration installation, landscaping, site preparation, and outdoor event space construction. The 6,000-square-foot building will be redeveloped into a wine production facility with part-time and full-time job opportunities, as well as seasonal positions, according to the release. 3 hurt in 2-vehicle wreck on icy Joe Davies County roadway. Elizabeth, Illinois is the dateline. 3 people were injured in a 2-vehicle crash Monday on an icy roadway in Joe Davies County. Madison D. Olson, 19, of Hanover, Jody M. Knight, 20, of Mount Carroll, and a young child were transported to Midwest Medical Center in Galena for treatment of their injuries, according to a press release from the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department. The release states that Olson was driving south on Illinois 84 South, approximately a quarter mile south of West Sawmill Road, at 12:06 p.m. with Knight and the child as passengers when she stopped to check on another vehicle that had slid off the roadway due to icy conditions. A southbound vehicle driven by Keith H. Kneffel, 64, of Hanover, was unable to stop and struck the rear of Olson's vehicle. Kneffel was not injured. The release states that the crash is being investigated. And police? The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported. Timothy Tillman, 43, of 1600 Butterfield Road, number 115, was arrested at 8:57 p.m. Monday at his residence on a charge of domestic assault with injury. Court documents state that Tillman assaulted Jacqueline Gardner, 37, of 3227 Getty Terrace. Angela C. Sullivan, 30, no known address, was arrested at 11:52 a.m. Monday in the 1000 block of Kaufman Avenue on a warrant charge of first-degree burglary. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Thomas J. Coakley, Maquoketa, Iowa. Thomas J. Coakley, 89, of Maquoketa, passed away at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics on Sunday, March 14, 2021, after a sudden illness. A memorial mass celebrating Tom's life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 22, 2021, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Maquoketa. A private burial will be at St. Lawrence Cemetery in Otter Creek. In lieu of other expressions of sympathy, memorials may be sent to Carson Celebration of Life Center, 318 West Pleasant Street, Maquoketa, Iowa, 52060, care of the Thomas J. Coakley family. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is caring for the family. Please feel free to call or stop at the funeral home with notes of support or leave words of comfort on the funeral home website at www.carsonandson.com. Carol L. Lorenz. Carol L. Lorenz, 73, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, March 14, 2021. Celebration of Life services will be held in June and will be announced. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2569 John F. Kennedy Road, is assisting the family. Allison H. Clancy. Allison Hope Clancy, 81, of Dubuque, passed away on Friday, March 12, 2021, surrounded by family. She was living at Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community in Waverly. Alice will be honored in a celebration of life in the summer of 2021 at Resurrection Cemetery in Asbury, Iowa. Please contact the family for details. Memorials may be directed to the family, and online condolences for Allison may be left at KaiserCorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home of Waverly, Iowa, is assisting the Clancy family with arrangements. 319-352-1187. Marjorie M. Sieverding. Marjorie M. Marge Sieverding, 85, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, March 16, 2021, at Hawkeye Care Center in Asbury. The Mass of Christian Burial for Marge will be 11 a.m. Thursday, March 18, 2021, at Church of the Nativity with Father Andy Upa as the celebrant. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. at the church. If you are not feeling well or are unable to attend, we encourage you to visit hskfhcares.com to send a message to Marjorie's family. Masks are required, and we ask that you please respect our current social distancing requirements. Entombment will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. The Mass will be live-streamed on Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at hskfhcares.com. Stephen W. Toole. Stephen William Thule, 62, of Dubuque, Iowa, passed away peacefully on March 14, 2021, at home, surrounded by his loved ones. A private family service will be held at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Online condolences may be left at www.leonardfuneralhome.com. Samuel W. Lang, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Samuel W. Lang, 79, of Dubuque, and formerly of Cuba City, Wisconsin, died on Monday, March 15, 2021. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Friday, March 19, at Immaculate Conception Parish Center in Keeler, Wisconsin. Funeral services will be held at 5 p.m. Friday at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Keeler. A private family burial will be held at a later date. Houdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Shirley Kahn, Guttenberg, Iowa. Shirley Kahn, 91, of Guttenberg, died on Monday, March 15, 2021. Visitation will be held from noon to 2 p.m. Friday, March 19, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Guttenberg, where a funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Interment will be in St. Mary's Cemetery in Guttenberg. Tukey Allen Funeral Home of Guttenberg is assisting the family. Milo G. Kettman, East Dubuque, Illinois. Milo G. Kettman, 78, of East Dubuque, died on Monday, March 15, 2021. There will be no public visitation. Massive Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 19, at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque. Burial will be in the Dubuque Cemetery. Funeral services. Zachary W. Brunton, Muskota, Wisconsin. Services 11 a.m. today. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville, Wisconsin. Virginia Johnson, Dubuque. Massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. today. Holy Ghost Catholic Church, Dubuque. Joanne O'Flaherty, Cobb, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. today. St. Philip Catholic Church, Highland, Wisconsin. Massive Christian burial, 11 a.m. today at the church. Michael J. Stolmeyer, East Moline, Illinois. Visitation 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, March 20th, Christ the King Church, Moline, Illinois. And 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, St. Andrew Catholic Church, Tennyson, Wisconsin. Services 10 a.m. Saturday, Christ the King Church, Moline. Florian Tigges, Jr., Asbury, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today. Hoffman, Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3860 Asbury Road. Massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Thursday, March 18th, Church of the Resurrection, Dubuque. Now we turn to the sports page and college wrestling NCAA championships. Excited Yet Confident, by Tim O'Neill. Max Lyon has been to the national tournament. He's wrestled on the big stage before. He's also had that opportunity ripped away from him. That's what makes this next opportunity so special. Purdue's 184-pounder, a two-time state champion from Western Dubuque, will make his second appearance at the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships this weekend in St. Louis. He's a three-time qualifier, but wasn't able to compete last year after the tournament was canceled at the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. "I'm just grateful," Lyon said on a Zoom call Monday. "When I went the first time, gosh, that was 2 years ago, I was pretty nervous. But now it's more of an excitement thing. I get to go wrestle. And that's been kind of my mantra this whole year. And coach Tony Ersland has been saying it a lot. Is we get to wrestle." Lyon, a senior, enters the national tournament with a 7-6 record after missing the first week of the season with COVID-19. He placed 7th at the Big Ten Conference Championships 2 weeks ago and is the number 16 seed in the 184-pound bracket. He was ranked as high as number 10 earlier in the season. Quote, "We train really hard here. It's not like missing 2 weeks was a huge detriment, really," Lyon said. "We work really hard on our shape and stuff like that, and so I felt prepared for this season. It was a little weird that I was short, but I'm very happy with the way we're going, individually and as a team. So I'm excited for these championships," unquote. He tied for the team lead with 6 wins over ranked opponents, including 3 in the top 10. 12 of his 13 opponents from the regular season are in his bracket at the tournament. Quote, "I'm glad I've had a tough schedule," said Lyon, who went 6-6 in those matches. "I know a lot of these guys in the other conferences haven't had it as hard, and I'm counting on them not wanting it hard like I do when we get down to St. Louis," unquote. Lyon has been continually evolving, his coach said, and that makes him an even more dangerous wrestler this weekend. Quote, "Max has always been one of those. He's going to wrestle hard, and he's going to give you everything he's got," Ersland said. "He's gritty, and he's stingy in his wrestling, and I think where he's kind of taken a jump this year, especially if you look at the Big Ten Championships, is he's shown he can score from a number of positions. Some guys used to sit back on Lyon's knee. Pull single to the opponent's right leg, and he's shown he's got a few different attacks from different places. Him being able to score from a few different places is going to bode well for him, where if guys just try to take away one particular shot or one attack, he's going to be able to score from the other places. And of course, as I said, He's got a big gas tank and he's going to wrestle hard, unquote. Lyon, who is 69 and 51 in his collegiate career, opens the tournament with a first round rubber match against Minnesota's 17th seeded Owen Webster on Thursday morning. Lyon split his two matches with Webster during the regular season, losing a 6-5 decision on January 31st before winning 3-1 in the seventh-place match at the Big Ten tournament. The winner would likely face top-seeded Aaron Brooks of Penn State in the second round. Lyon did not wrestle Brooks in the regular season. Quote, "We have every right to be confident," Lyon said, speaking about himself and the team. "We've been training hard. Like Coach said, I've been working on varying my attacks. I have no reason to go into this tournament with anything but excitement and energy and a positive attitude," unquote. And now turning to the United States Hockey League, Green Bay 6, Saints 4. Gamblers edged the Saints by Jim Leitner. Alex Cervano scored from a sharp angle with 2 minutes and 30 seconds remaining in regulation time to lift the Green Bay Gamblers to a 6-4 victory over the Dubuque Fighting Saints on Tuesday night at the Resch Center in Green Bay. Cervano broke a 4-4 tie on a shot from the left faceoff circle that handcuffed goalie Hobie Hedquist. Damian Carfagna added an empty net goal for the final margin. The game took an ugly turn with 1 minute and 58 seconds remaining when Boston Bruins second-round draft pick Mason Lowry delivered a hit to the head of Dubuque's Ryan Alexander, leaving a pool of blood at center ice. Lowry received a 5-minute major and game ejection for the suspendable hit. Green Bay opened the scoring on a Camden Thiessing power play goal at 14 minutes and 29 seconds of the first period. Lowry's shot from the left point appeared to be headed wide, but Thiessing got a stick on it to direct it past goalie Hobie Hedquist for his 14th goal of the season. Matt Savoy tied it with a stellar individual play just 4 minutes and 20 seconds later. He pickpocketed Lowry as the defenseman tried to make a pass from deep in his own zone. Savoy decked goalie Matt Davis to the left before shifting to his forehand and tucking the puck into a wide-open net for his 10th goal of the season. Dubuque finished with a 15-8 advantage in first-period shots, despite Green Bay enjoying the only 2 power plays of the frame. The Saints converted a 3-on-2 rush 6 minutes and 41 seconds into the second period to take their first lead of the game. Ian Pierce carried into the Green Bay zone and made a drop pass to Daniel Dejaniev, who made a cross-ice pass to Connor Kurth in the left face-off circle. Davis stopped Kurth's shot, but Pierce scored on the rebound for his 5th goal of the season. Carfagna knotted the score at 2-2 just 4 minutes and 8 seconds later with his 2nd of the season. He scored on a wrist shot from the high slot after carrying the puck in from the neutral zone. Green Bay regained the lead at the 14-minute, 30-second mark. Thiessing took a Carfagna feed and circled around the Dubuque zone before wiring a shot just out of the reach of Hedquist's glove hand. Robert Cronin tied the game again at the 14-minute and 13-second mark of the third period. Stephen Halliday carried the puck along the left wall, circled behind the net, and took a sharp-angle shot on Davis. Cronin punched the rebound for his team-high 16th goal of the year. Savoy picked up a secondary assist. Just 38 seconds later, Ryan Kerwin scored his 17th of the year by following his own shot to give the Gamblers a 4-3 cushion. But Max Montes needed only 17 seconds to tie it again. P.J. Fletcher moved the puck to the net front, and Montes flicked it into the net before Davis could cover in the blue paint for his 5th of the season. Dubuque finished with a 42-30 advantage in shots. And now, turning to the Tri-State page, the headline is, "Authorities: Dubuque man arrested for 3rd assault." A Dubuque man accused of biting off the nose of another man as well as assaulting 2 people in a separate incident now has been charged with a third unrelated attack that left a man with a broken arm. Blair A. Ward, 24, of 930 West Locust Street, was arrested at 8:45 a.m. Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging assault causing serious injury. The charges stem from an attack at about 1:50 a.m. September 26th. Court documents state that Brittany R. Hoover, 25, and her boyfriend, Shane A. Faulkner, 33, were arguing in the 1800 block of Central Avenue when Ward interjected himself from the other side of the street and started assaulting Faulkner. The attack lasted about 2 minutes. Two friends of Ward, one identified as John F. Turner III, 20, walked several blocks and joined in on the assault by kicking up Faulkner while he was down. Faulkner's injuries included a compound fracture of his left forearm. Faulkner was not completely coherent and believed he had been hit by a car, documents state. Hoover picked Ward out of a lineup last month and a warrant for his arrest was issued March 5th. Online court records do not show any related charges filed against Turner as of Tuesday afternoon. Ward already faces charges related to two other incidents, one of which occurred about 24 hours after the attack on Faulkner. Court documents state that Ward assaulted Dylan L. Dahlman, 21, during a disturbance at about 1:25 a.m. September 27th in the area of East 16th Street and Central Avenue. Dahlman fell to the ground after being punched, and Ward kicked Dahlman twice, according to documents. Ward then allegedly punched Crystal A. Parr, 40. Parr told authorities that she had been walking north on Central Avenue when she saw Ward assault Dahlman. He is charged with assault with injury and assault in connection with those events. About 3 weeks later, Ward is accused of biting off the nose of Scott M. Plumley, 44, of 2836 Central Avenue, and assaulting his son, Austin J. Plumley, 21, of Gothenburg, Iowa, in the 1400 block of Bluff Street after 11:30 p.m. on October 17th. Ward was arrested on charges of willful injury causing serious injury, first-degree harassment, assault causing injury, fourth-degree criminal mischief, and interference with official acts. Documents state that Turner also was involved in that brawl, and he subsequently pleaded guilty to one count of assault, for which he was sentenced to 2 years of probation. Two candidates vying for seat on Platteville Council, by Bennett Goldstein. The dateline is Platteville, Wisconsin. Two candidates will face off for a 3-year term on the Platteville Common Council during the April 6th election. Longtime incumbent Ken Killian is being challenged by Lynn Parrott for the District 4 seat. Like others in municipalities and school districts across the nation, Platteville leaders have grappled with the COVID-19 pandemic and a new focus on diversity and inclusion over the past year. Meanwhile, in the face of decades of diminishing state aid, the city is looking to other sources of revenue to finance the inflating costs of providing services. Ken Killian, age 86, profession, retired agronomy professor. Relevant experience. Has served on the council since the mid-1980s with occasional gaps. Killian said he seeks re-election because he desires to help people. Quote, I try to study the issues and I try to be very concerned about individuals, he said. To me, the government should be for providing services to the people, unquote. Killian believes Platteville must prioritize attracting residents with well-paying jobs so they can afford to purchase homes, increasing commerce and the city's tax base. He hopes that a new $20 million facility that will be constructed over the next year and occupied by Fortune 500 company Cummins will attract new residents to Platteville. The engine and power generator manufacturer intends to employ 200 to 220 full-time personnel in the city. Killian believes the city faces challenges attempting to fund its roads for lack of increasing property tax revenue or state and federal assistance. He also hopes to see a new fire station constructed. Lynn Parrott, age 54, profession, pastor, notary, and communications consultant and trainer. Relevant experience. Family Advocates board member, Platteville Police Department chaplain, and community organizer. Parrott, who is completing her doctorate in organizational leadership, said her experience leading organizations for more than two decades lends itself well to serving on the council. Parrott, who is Black, believes it is important for local government to reflect the city's diversity. About 6% of the community identifies as persons of color or as multiracial. Quote, I want to be that voice, she said. She also hopes to improve city communication with all residents, particularly about opportunities to become involved in city government. Quote, Platteville has a page that we use, but you've got older people who don't do the internet, Parrott said. We have to find a way to reach everybody, unquote. She supports efforts to attract minorities to the new jobs that Cummins will bring to Platteville and to existing businesses in both entry-level and leadership positions. Parrott said the city is making the best of its resources in maintaining its roads and water service, but she hopes to avoid leaning too heavily on local property taxes when residents and businesses already are struggling. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.